Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, as we head into Thanksgiving week, this really kicks off a time when people find the warm excuse to get together, whether it's holidays, work, family, or friends. And after last year, this time might take on deeper meaning because many of us simply couldn't be with each other physically. So on the one hand, there's this overdue excitement, but also the past 20 months involved some tough conversations about the choices that we made and are making during the pandemic. Whether it was masks, vaccines, not to mention boosters, conversations could turn heated. Oh, and there was a deeply politicized election that still reverberates today. So with all of that, let's find some tools to handle these conversations with grace. Rosalinda Randall is a civility and etiquette expert and author of Keep Your Distance, Your Guide to Handling Common Dilemmas in Uncommon Times. Rosalinda, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So this is a topic a lot of people are talking about, regardless of where people stand. But before we get into specific scenarios, is there a guiding compass, maybe like a mantra we should keep at front of mind when heading to gatherings this season?
Well, for me personally, and I like to share it, is when I'm going to respond to something that triggers me or offends me or whatever, my first question is, what is my purpose in replying? That's simple. If it's to prove someone wrong, to challenge them, to change their mind, it is going to be the most unproductive time and, again, damaging, tarnishing relationships and sometimes ending a relationship. So that is what I base anything, whether it's on social media, verbally, you know, with family, friends, it doesn't matter. Is it worth it? Is it helpful? How will this help if I respond? And most of the time, what I decide, it is not worth responding. I listen, whether I agree or not, and let them go, especially if I see that they're fervent about something. There's nonstop. I can't get a word in edgewise. I know that they're not in a position, and that's an assumption of mine, but from what I'm gathering, to hear, to have a conversation. It is merely something they want to dump on you. And that's when I make that decision, like, okay. And then we end it. And I say, well, thanks. It was an interesting point of view. And I walk away.
Right. Just pausing, because, you know, our reaction sometimes can be knee jerk. And if you just take a couple seconds to ask yourself that question, reflect on it, which really is just a second or two, that kind of can cool whatever is going on inside of you when you're hearing something that is bothering you or triggering you. We got a lot of actually specific questions from colleagues and people like that sent them in. So let's just run through them. So you're having guests over. You want to be safe. You want to make sure that everyone's vaccinated. But how do you say that or infer that in an invitation without being rude or alienating a loved one who is not vaccinated?
You know, pre this, it would have been very rude to ask or demand or, you know, any of those things in the past from your guests. But now it is becoming acceptable. Some people aren't accepting it, but you can choose not to answer. So my basic rule is your house, your rules. You know, if you're hosting it and these are the things, the protocols that you want to have, then yes, it is definitely, when you do invite people, definitely tell them that masks will be required or you will show proof of vaccination. A lot of people are unhappy with that because of, you know, privacy issues. But you definitely need to tell your guests in advance what the protocols will be. Will you be offering food? Will you not? Are pets allowed? Are children all supposed to be vaccinated as well? Are you going to provide social distancing? What is the food situation like? You're going to be changing the utensils regularly, and then allow for people to decline. That's the other thing. As a host, people may not want to do that. And also, if they come from different counties and they're used to, I just came from San Diego.
Or different
and
states.
There's no
even.
One wearing any masks. Yes, different states. So consider that and do your research. That's one of the most important things. If you're going to host something, what is your particular county mandating? Or is it just your personal request and preference?
On the flip side, you're invited to a holiday party, but the invitation doesn't really make a mention of wanting people to be vaccinated, or even if the party's going to be outdoors or indoors, how do you politely ask the hosts about this to ease your concerns?
Again, I've been asked that even for hairstylists or masseuses. Can I ask them? Can I make them wear masks? Yes, during this time, and you said the key word, politely ask, not impose, not command or demand. That's where people get a little bit, confused. So out of concern, an email, that's what we normally do, or text. But under these circumstances, I would probably call and just say, hi, I'm a little concerned, or whatever your concerns are. Will you be having this, this, or this, whatever is important to you? And they will say yes or no. And then you say, thanks so much, I'll let you know in a couple of days, and make your decision. We can decline. And without explanation, however, most of us expect an explanation or even ask why, depending on the level of the relationship that you have. So again, you can decline, just say, I'm not comfortable. Be honest, just say, I'm not comfortable under the circumstances. You know, maybe we can get together in a different venue after the holidays. Simple.
Yeah.
And don't post like, oh, ridiculous, people are having this. And, you know, my sister-in-law, because I've seen that, people on their own family saying, having a gathering, look at this, without masks. We don't need to, tell on people, so to speak, or snitch. Just make your decision and allow people to do what they need to do. Simple.
We also got another question about if you decline an invitation, but you don't really give a reason why. And the reason is because you're unsure about how safe the gathering is going to be. But then the host reaches out and asks why you can't make it. How do you reply to that?
Again, depending on your relationship with this person, you know, that's a big one. If you're very close to them, just say, look, I'm not ready. They may try and talk you into it and just say, thanks, I appreciate it, but we're going to pass on this. Or you can even, if you're really unsure, you can also stop by for just a little while. If it's outdoors, I mean, there are different options, but you can just definitely say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not ready to go. And if they insist, just repeat. Mm-hmm. That's the safest thing. Thank you, but I'm not ready to go.
And you brought up a good point. It depends on who you're talking to and the relationship you have. What if it's someone that you hold in high regard? Maybe it's your parents or grandparents. How do you approach this without creating conflict and hurting their feelings because you respect them so much?
You can't. You know, that old saying, you can't control how other people are going to respond or feel by your decision. If there's a way to accommodate them with you still feeling comfortable, whatever that might be, then you can plan something accordingly. However, if they're going to get their feelings hurt, you apologize and you say, honest, we'll get together as soon as this is over. That's all you can do. You know, I've been asked that, like, well, do I do it? Exactly what you said, don't hurt their feelings. You can, but are you going to feel comfortable? Are you going to regret that? What if you do get COVID because of the interaction or give it to them? You're going to feel worse. So I always say, go with your gut. But when you make this decision, try not to come from a political standpoint or a staunch, this is what I think and that's it. Consider the circumstances. That is where you may want to come from when you make these decisions.
Yeah, it's also difficult having these conversations with your children. You know, your kids want to have friends over during the holiday break. And how do you approach this issue with the parents of your child's friends or even your children if you want your household to remain vaccinated?
That's a really, really tough situation with children. I feel that's the group that I feel the worst with for. Nothing you can do but explain. And they don't get the concept. They're living today, right now, and they want to play and their friends inviting them. I did have neighbors who that happened to. They met walking down the street and say, can he come over? And they said no. And there was no reason. And they started to cry. So it's a really tough one that you might have to explain to your child and find something different. That's where it comes in with the parents. Like, you know, we're not going to be able to do that, but let's do this and be creative and find other things that will bring their attention or go to a park, something different so that they feel that they're doing something fun.
Yeah. This is an interesting question that we got, and it's actually something I've experienced on a flight. As a passenger, what should you do if someone is acting unruly or acting out against a flight attendant? You know, do you just stand there or really sit there? How do you handle that situation that makes you feel uncomfortable because someone's being harassed?
The first thing, and I've spoken to several flight attendants about this, is push your button. And they said, that's what it's for. Call us before you even say anything if you feel uncomfortable. And on several flights now, they say, if you feel uncomfortable, please push the red button, let us know. That's the best, but sometimes we feel a little hesitant because of any repercussions if they watch us push the button or speak to a flight attendant. What you can do is excuse yourself depending on which seat you're in and go to the back of the plane and privately speak to someone and let them go and approach that person. I do recall someone, and then this had nothing to do with COVID or anything like that, but they didn't have their headset and it was bothering everyone. They were listening to a movie on a long flight, and that person was told 3 to 4 times. And finally, the flight attendants gave up and we all had to put up with it. So, you know, sometimes they pick and choose also what they said, depending on the feel of that particular passenger, which isn't fair to everyone else. But then again, do we want a brawl? Or do we want to all put up with a little noise because of the potential violence that could occur? Mm. But for yourself, if you're sitting next to someone, which I was, that had their mask down and they weren't eating, it didn't bother me or upset me. And again, it's a personal choice.
Right.
I could have said something, but I chose not to. So we pick and choose.
Thank you so much, Rosalinda, helping us ease through and remember just to enjoy time with each other.
Yes. And if I can leave everyone with a final note is we can try and spend our energy and our time and our words in trying to maintain our relationships instead of really breaking them apart.
Rosalinda Randall is the author of Keep Your Distance, Your Guide to Handling Common Dilemmas in Uncommon Times. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We have a wonderful, far from guaranteed update on a Sacramento Afghan family we've been following here on Insight. The family with 3 children in Sac City Unified are safely back home, 3 months after being in limbo following the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Now, this is one of dozens of families in our immediate area fighting to get home. Some have succeeded while others are still fighting. I met Huma and Ramatullah last week at Ethel I. Baker Elementary. The parents and their 3 children just touched down days before in Sacramento with Principal Nate McGill and other school staff welcoming them at the airport with wide open arms and arguably even bigger smiles. Rayhan, Faizan, and Pakiza are in 1st, 3rd, and 4th grade. Their first day at Ethel I. Baker was last week, now adjusting back to life as healthy, happy kids following unbearable circumstances. I spoke at length with their mother, Huma, and father, Ramatullah, and Principal Nate McGill. Here's their story. How did it feel touching down in Sacramento at the airport and walking out and seeing the people that have been thinking about you every moment during this time?
Yeah, it was like a dream when we came back here, because after several attempts to flee from country, from a bad situation, finally, so when we arrived there, my kids were like a bird out of prison, you know. They were so happy. They hugged their principal and they thanked them and they thanked their teachers.
The day we arrived to the Sacramento airport, after that I just take a deep breath and said, finally we arrived to our home and back to the U.S. And I was really excited to see my kids, the way they are jumping and they are hugging and they show their happiness. So it was the best moment in my life that when they came on Monday to the school, and the way they shows their excitement in the school, it was an unforgettable day for me. So I'm feeling really good to get back to the home and get back kids to the school.
I told them that it is humanity, you know. They're saving lives here and some people are taking life there.
How do you reflect on the last couple months and just really fighting to get your family back here?
As a mother, like these 3 months is very heavy on my other whole life. Because these 3 months we struggle a lot. We like depress a lot in our country. Every day a new incident, every day a new story, every day a new violations. So it was a very it was very effect on our brain and on my kids. The way they're asking on this age, it was like unacceptable for me that in this age they are asking me such a questions. So I was really worried for them and especially to my husband, because in my country, male, female, everyone was inside at home. So there was no difference between male and female because everybody was escaping and hiding. So that is a very bad days and that we spend it there. These 3 months is really, really too hard and horrible.
When you were in Afghanistan, were you and your family essentially in hiding? How did you stay under the radar until you were able to leave safely?
We all were hiding there, but some, especially when some people say that there are some insurgents are going in this way, or somebody were asking about you guys, or somebody asked that what are you guys doing, what is your job? So somebody asked what these kids are from outside of country, not from Afghanistan. So we really were afraid, and you know, we tried to keep them and at home, my kids, and the kids also afraid, and it was really heartbreaking for us hiding myself at home. It's like a human being is hiding himself from another human being. It's frustrating.
How did you navigate those conversations with your children that are so young, dealing with something so grave that even any adult would find incredibly challenging?
In one home, we were living more than 30 people. So all of them were following social medias and the incidents, the securities. So if one person raised the issues, everyone was around. So kids were listen, and later on they were asking, oh mom, is this Taliban are really dangerous? Is they are killing the people who came from the US? Is they will kill us as well? So this kind of question, it was really hard to me to answer them, but I try a lot to keep calm.
Yeah, I was just comforting them that I can beat anybody if come here to take you from us, so I can beat them. They were smiling, oh, my dad is smart, my dad is strong, he can protect us. So it was the way that we were comforting them.
Definitely, we were really depressed. Sometimes, we got panic attacks. So for the treatment also is a big issue, how we can go out, because in front of the house a few checkpoints of the Taliban, because next to the houses there was Indian consulate, Iranian consulate. So definitely if you go in and go out too much, definitely they are asking, they are stopping, what are these people are doing, what is their job. So many times when we got panic attacks, so we call the doctor and we bring them inside the home, and then we do the treatment. So most of the time we get depressed. So thanks to my kids' teacher, most of the time they send their stories, their incredible family stories. So when he is explaining or when I was reading it, so especially the message of the principal, so he was regularly sending the message to the kids. So a little bit we get relaxed and we were encouraging. So on that way we just complete these 3 months.
Did you and your family have a conversation about the possibility that you wouldn't be able to come back here, and that how you would continue to live your lives in Afghanistan?
So we comfort them that we are trying, still we are trying to take you guys out of this situation. Me, my wife, and Mr. Ned, we are trying to, we are calling everybody who can help us. So take them out, please. Some lives are at risk, really at risk. Some people are not at risk. I cannot say everybody is at risk in Afghanistan, but some people are really at risk, especially those who have worked for US projects, especially who are interpreters, or especially who has some family here. So these people are not safe.
I was go from there as a very happy moment that to see my family, especially my mother. She is a heart patient, so she was really sick. So I just visit her to see her, and my in-law family, my father-in-law and mother-in-law, they are also. So I was just very excited to see them. We were planning to be back on 26 August, but when we he came and we celebrated the Eid, and the soon after the Eid, on 15 August, everything everything is changed, which is unacceptable for me. I didn't thought that maybe these people can come and they take the power like that much easily. So that was the big concern to me, that how it's possible. And then we on 31st August, when the US force lifted Afghanistan, we totally lost the hope. We said, oh, now we cannot go out safely. So then starting traveling and hiding.
Wow. You mentioned your mother is a heart patient. How is she doing?
She's really suffering. She's the one who is really suffering for me. My father-in-law is paralyzed. He is the one who is most suffering from everybody. My mother-in-law is the same. So we have a few families. My mother, she's heart patient, diabetes. So as she heard about us that we are in danger, then the BP is automatically is to be high. So controlling of her is also a big deal for us. So as we arrive here, she was really happy.
And although you're having a weight of relief, I mean, a big chunk of your hearts are still in Afghanistan with your families and loved ones.
Yes. The day we arrived here, we were really excited. But on another hand, we were worried for them as well.
Still, I communicate with them once a day or twice a day. So still we are trying, and we are calling the U.S. state, to U.S. Government, to help these people and please save their lives. Everybody is at risk there when they know that they have relatives, they have sons and brothers in U.S. and they are not safe. Just I can say that we should save them, we should protect them.
When hearing about when the Taliban now taking control of Afghanistan, A huge overarching concern is the future of girls, of women in that country. You have a daughter. Mm-hmm. When you were in Afghanistan, what level of concern did you have?
The day they came, I just totally stopped my kids to go outside. So in these 3 months, my kids didn't see outside. They were inside of the home. So everybody in my home, in my in-law, in my father, in my father family, the girls, the boys, everybody sat at home. Still they are not going to school because they are not feeling secure and they are not allowing them to go to the school. For my daughter, from one hand I was a little bit trust that, oh, whenever we back safely to the home, I'm sure she can catch up everything very soon. But once we get out safely from here, so I just totally hide my kids in these 3 months. I didn't leave them, even I didn't leave them to go away from my eyes. So I was following them everywhere.
You know, your story is so important because it's not just one story. You know, there are thousands of families that are fighting for the same thing, and it's really important to continue having these conversations. What more do you want people to know?
It is this destroy the 20 years hard work of everybody. Like we were serving from 10, 12 days, it is destroyed because I was trying to I was working for the empowerment of women. It was newly started women for the higher education, for the to know of their rights and their the laws. So suddenly everything is destroyed. They are playing with the futures of everybody because if a girls wear jeans, they are killing them. The day on 4th November, they killed four social activist women. So for right in the moment, it's very easy to kill someone there. For them, it's very easy. It's not acceptable.
I don't even have words for that. That's just so unfortunate and awful when you think about what is happening in Afghanistan, and especially when talking to the both of you that speak multiple languages, you're highly educated, and that isn't possible to move forward with this new regime.
I work for human rights in Afghanistan, and my wife's also work in several youth projects in Afghanistan. So she has a bachelor degree, and I was doing my master degree. We both can speak 4 or 5 languages.
Yes, actually, when 2017 we came here, I had this hope that I will have a good official jobs here as I had in my own country, because I work with the United Nations as a political affairs assistant as well for a few years. I work with the different position, like even as a project manager, as a community coordinator. So I try a lot to here to be had a professional a job. But since last this 3-4 years, I couldn't find even a normal job for myself. That was a little bit sad moment for me, because my husband already explained you, because when I saw him, like before years, he was doing a cashier job. So I feel sad that he was a student of MA, master, bachelor degree he was doing in my country. He was working like recovering the refugees as an officer. And now he is doing this cashier's job, and me, I become as a housewife because I have my own career, so I want to build my career to be as a professional lady. So let's hope for the best. I heard some positive news that the school district already approved a vacancy and a positions. So definitely I will try my best, I will apply, and I hope we get it. One of us maybe get it, inshallah. So
it's so wonderful having you here and your family safe in Sacramento. Your children are just so happy to be here back in school. Are you concerned about them in the months to come, just with healing and anything that they endured, the trauma and the fear that they went through? Or are they pretty resilient and they're kind of already getting back to being what they should be, normal, healthy, happy children?
We are trying because I know these 3 months, it's affect a lot their brains. So I know it will take time to come back and catch up everything and to start a normal life. So definitely we will work with them. The school is already doing their hard work, and they are also already requested to the teachers, if possible, once a week or twice a week, some 1 hour extra classes or two, because they were far away from 3 months to the schools. So maybe they will recover soon.
As a school principal of a little over 600 students, there's not a lot of downtime. So have you even given yourself some time to pause and reflect on the past 3 months?
Yeah, here or there. I think I was asked the question about what it feels like in the moment, and in the moment, just as they described, it's stressful or can be trying. I've had some downtime, and the emotions that I feel are pretty intense about it. The just kind of the amount of energy we all put into each other, the family and I, to get this thing done, was really amazing. I think that's what I reflect on, that kind of the amount of, like I said, amount of energy or care or time or effort that these two and our team put into making this happen is kind of incredible, what it took to get five folks from Afghanistan back to the United States.
How did it feel to touch down here and see Nate and all the other people that were working so hard to get you back and thinking of your family during this time?
During the hard time, when we lost our hopes, their emails, their like the way they are working for us to take us safely out, that is very encourageable and unforgettable. So it was really excited moment when we arrived here, when we saw the kids principals. He really hard worked for us a lot because the many nights he was awake, because there is difference of day and night here and there. So most of the time when we feel really depressed, we text him, we disturb him in after without waiting of a minute, we receive the replay. So when we came here, we just already like talk with each other that is unforgettable hard works and their efforts for us. So that is, we really thankful of them.
When you got the call that they were going to be hopping on a flight, landing in Sacramento, what did you do between the time you got that call and seeing their faces at the airport?
During those roughly 48 hours of them in the evacuation process, it was incredibly stressful on this side, which means that on their side, it was almost unbearable, I think, what would have been the tension and the possible danger. But the most emotional moment was when they had sent me a picture from just right before they were about to leave Afghanistan, and then we knew that it was real, and that was a pretty incredible moment. So we feel relief that we did this first part of the project, and then the second part of the project is getting everybody up to speed, making sure that the family is set up from a system standpoint to be okay, to be sustainable, to get the jobs that they like, make sure that the kids have the kind of mental health and academic resources that they need, but the same for the parents. So while it was a tremendous feat to get them back, this is just the first part in the process of making sure that they have a future in front of them that will bring them what they want.
How are their children doing, your students? They're all students here.
Now they're here and all the kids are out at recess, they're back in classes. So my hope is that it feels very normal to them. They're doing well, but at the same time, we know that just as both parents expressed, there is an effect on their wellness, on their mental health, to be able to endure what they endured. That's not normal. And for such a long period, our big concern is that they have, you know, mental health needs that we have to address, and that's our responsibility.
What resources do you have as educators to help them through this?
So luckily, the focus of our school outside of the academics is serving the mental health needs of the community, where our community is, you know, disproportionately affected by trauma in its various forms. And so we know that the right sort of counseling, support, mentoring, mental health resources as a basis of our school. So that happens every single day. So we have a full-time therapist, we have a social worker, we have a mental health coordinator on top of myself and my assistant principal. And then we ask that all teachers bring that idea of wellness into the classroom. And so we know that kids can't activate their thinking and learning brain unless they feel safe, that they're in a good mental health state. And so that's kind of what we do.
Talk to us about the neighborhood and your student population. It's incredibly diverse.
Incredibly diverse. So many languages spoken. In the majority of the households, the primary language is not English. We have, from a socioeconomic standpoint, more challenges than probably the next neighborhood or one of them, being in South Sacramento. But it's a neighborhood that I love. I went to school down the street from here. And so the diversity, both linguistic and ethnic, makes this place special.
You went above and beyond as a principal of an elementary school, and the relationship that you developed with this family was very personal and intimate, and sharing stories from such an uncertain and terrifying ordeal that they went through. How did all of this shape you as a person?
I think I'm just inspired inspired by what they did for their kids and for their family more than anything. Like, you know, we see stories of resilience every single day. This just has to be one of the most compelling that I've ever heard. In terms of how it shaped me, maybe time will tell on that, but I do think it brings to light the immigrant story for the United States and how important it is that we listen to how folks have gotten here and the countries that at times they leave behind. Going back to the diversity question, we have so many immigrant stories here. And actually, when I shared with the staff last week that they were touching down, many of my staff members either emailed back or came up to me and said, you know, by the way, I came here when I was 7. I came here when I was 10 with my whole extended family. And I do think we lose sight of that because we don't take the time to pay attention to everybody's story. And they're going to have a really good story, and so are their kids.
What kind of welcoming did they have on Monday, the students?
There were a lot of tears. In Pakiza's class, the teacher was pretty emotional, and everyone was really emotional, you know. So during this time, like they said, our team was kind of pulling for them daily, and you know, we might send each other email updates or text updates about what was going on, and so a huge sigh of relief. But I, you know, that first morning on the blacktop, which would have been Monday morning, kind of everybody in the school community is aware of this story, so they were like, oh, is that the family? Are those the kids? Can we go talk to them? You know, and so everyone knows that what they did was extraordinary.
They did a lot for us. You know, it was mission impossible if they were not here. So these people helped a lot and saved some lives, you know, and got some kids back to school. And that is the big message, and that is a big message of humanity for other people, for other countries, that it is the difference between these people and our new government. Those are stopping kids from going to school, and these are bringing their students from 7,000 miles back to their school. So it's a big difference. So I thank God that we are back to our home here and we feel safe.
And that is my conversation with Huma and Ramatula, the parents of Ethel I. Baker Elementary students Raihan, Faizan, and Pakiza, as well as Principal Nate McGill. The family safely returned home after 3 months of hiding in Afghanistan following the U.S. withdrawal. Our conversation was recorded last week, and we have photos of the family on our Insight page at capradio.org. Still ahead, he is making Sacramento proud on the classical music scene. Meet solo violinist Chase Spruill next. And remember, you can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Philip Glass. Some of the words used to describe his work include iconic, influential. His compositions include operas, theater productions, symphonies, and Academy Award-nominated film scores, just to name a few. Well, a local violinist is taking some of Philip Glass's work to a whole new level. Chase Spruill is a native of Vacaville, a Sacramento State graduate, and a close friend of Cap Radio. Chase is also a concertmaster for the Auburn Symphony and Sacramento's Camellia Symphony, and just released a solo album of Philip Glass works. Chase joins us along with Cap Radio's Midday Classical host, Jennifer Reason. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us, Vicky.
Hello, thanks for having us.
All right, Jennifer, let's start with you. You've known Chase for years. You've collaborated together. Talk to us about what inspires you about his music and his career.
Yes, I've been lucky enough to know Chase for, gosh, since we were maybe 11 years old.
Wow.
There's two things that have just been completely consistently true about Chase, and that is just pursuit of more, pursuit of better, pursuit of these higher endeavors, and then everything he just goes after with such just veracity and tenacity too, but brings this thoughtfulness that I don't encounter all that often. Just the care and the thoughtfulness to create high art is just profoundly present in Chase. And that is so inspiring to me.
I love that you've known each other since you were 11.
Yes.
Well, Chase, take us back a few years. Share with us, you know, your musical journey and what inspired you to the music and really led you to the music of Philip Glass.
I'm just grateful that Jen didn't bring out any embarrassing like haircut stories.
Thought about it. I did.
When I first encountered Philip Glass's music, I was pretty young. I was about 12 or 13 years old. And Jen knows the story very well, that I'd gotten pretty seriously hurt in school with an injury that had me like bedridden, wheelchair bound, in and out of surgeries for 2 years, which meant that I was missing a lot of school, a lot of normal experiences. But I had just started in like public school music classes just about a year before, and I was out of school at the time, doing like rehab and everything, and the one thing that I had with me was my violin. So my dad at the time, when I was like upstairs in my room and I had my wheelchair, he figured out how to take the arms off of the wheelchair so I could like at least sit there and practice and try to make music. And right around that time, I was also developing my love of scary movies, and probably scary movies I wasn't supposed to watch. And one of them happened to be the movie Candyman. And I would, you know, turn the volume way down late at night so my parents didn't know that I was watching these pretty brutal scenes. But I was falling in love with that hypnotic score happening in the background, and I would just stay to the very end of the credits. And if I caught it again later on, I'd pull my violin out and start trying to play those same notes. And it was later on that I realized Philip Glass was responsible for the music.
Yeah, I think for me as a kid, it was It.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, and regretted watching that in fifth grade. Well, Chase, your album is called A Common Time. When did you decide that all of this music should come together, and why now?
It wasn't something we set out to do originally. You know, Jennifer and I, we had this conversation last year around the incident, the terrible incident of the murder of George Floyd. And one of the things that stuck out to me was that when we first had the conversation, we were in this confused space about not knowing how to articulate how we were feeling about the moment. Obviously, we were all feeling something of a kind, and it was our first time seeing something so publicly visceral and devastating. And what I noticed was that friends, colleagues, people on the news, they were all so articulate with what they were thinking and feeling. And I wasn't one of those people who could strike out and have a comfortable conversation about it. And one of the people I was talking to every day, you know, during the course of the pandemic and during that moment of the Black Lives Matter protests, is my friend Richard Guerin, who works closely with Philip Glass and runs his label. And every day, there would just be some conversation that was really thought-provoking, but still, I didn't have anything to say that I thought was impactful. And I think instinctually, Richard would just start talking to me about music in that time. And he would say, "Hey, have you ever heard the epilogue to the movie Bent? It's this great score by Philip Glass. It ends with a solo violin thing." "No, I don't know that." And he would send me the music and I would play it, and it felt right all of a sudden. Like I had a place to put feelings or any sort of emotion or thought that I couldn't articulate with words. Suddenly I was able to do it with music. And that's kind of how the project started. It was never like, we're going to sit down and we're going to make some album that's going to speak to the moment. It wasn't that. It was just like month by month of me thinking, okay, it's going to get better now. And then it would get absolutely worse. And then I talked to Richard about it. He'd articulate something in a way that was impactful. I couldn't. And then he'd mention some piece of music and we were off and running again. So that's sort of how it came together. But I'm really grateful that it did.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to where you drew your inspiration. Let's listen to some of your music. This first track is called Saraband in Common Time. I mean, you really just feel like the gravity of somberness is what I take from it. It's so profound, Chase.
Well, I really appreciate, that's really kind of you to say. Thank you. I hope that I imagine that feelings that I'm having are not uncommon when we see these sorts of things. So I really hope that if anybody's, if I can relate to anybody on any level, maybe they find a way to put their feelings in this music, or Philip Skor has a way of speaking to the woman the same way it speaks to me. So, I mean, I really appreciate you saying that. Thanks.
Let's listen to the second track. It's called Primacy of Number. Gotta say, you two, Chase and Jennifer, must have so much fun with each other.
Oh my god. So much fun.
A lot of fun all the time.
Well, thank you so much, Chase. We're actually gonna end with the third track, Candy Man, but before we let both of you go, I just want to thank the both of you for sharing this, and I just know so many people are gonna listen to this. It's just wonderful.
So glad.
Thank you so much, everyone. Really appreciate it.
And that is local violinist Chase Sproul, who just released a solo album of Philip Glass works, and Cap Radio's midday classical host, Jennifer Reason. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez, Nick Dobis, and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Insight will be off next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, but we will return the following week on Monday, November 29th. From all of us, have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, and we're going to leave you with more of Chase Sproul's work.